Hello, everyone. Welcome to an exciting episode of ARG Presents. I am Amigo Aaron, joined this week by a man who knows how to push my buttons in a bad way. I give you the Brent. What's going on,
hey, what's
the Brent?
Up, man?
How you feeling this week?
I am feeling well. How about yourself?
I'm always feeling great, all the time. It never ends. So if you joined us last week, and some of you did, wasn't our best week, Brent. We spun the wheel. We made the deal. And this week, in an interesting week of spinning, we've come up with something that I hadn't really thought of until this week. Arcade games with no buttons. Buttons allowed, Brent, except for maybe a start button. And this was an exciting challenge to try to come up with games that fit this category and then come up with some that were exciting to play. Had you ever considered this until this week?
Absolutely.
You had considered it. Was this one of yours, or was this a...
I don't know if this was one of mine. I'd have to go back to the archives.
Yeah.
But I am always, always looking for arcade games that have interesting control schemes. We kind of cheesed it out.
What? What do you mean?
Because... I mean, a joystick is just four directional buttons. I think in the true core of this challenge would have been playing games that were, steering wheel but no pedals. It would have been canoe rowing paddles. It would have been...
You mean stuff you can't play at home, is what you're saying.
That's the problem. The unemulatable games are the ones that really fit this category the best.
I know you were dying to play some arm wrestling game or one of those strength testers, but that's not within the realm of availability.
No. There is an arm wrestling game that is an actual video game. It has a video screen and everything else.
Yeah, I've seen it, yeah. The same guys that made the horseshoe game, right?
Yeah, I believe so. That would have been perfect for this challenge.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, how can you emulate that? How can you give that a fair shake, a fair playthrough? So we had to kind of compromise and choose games that just didn't use physical buttons for its gameplay.
Yeah. It's funny. I sat down and I found some people that were talking about this I think it was Reddit. And I looked at their list and sort of pulled it and then added a few to it. But most of the games on a list like this are going to be games that are your twin stick shooters. And even a lot of those don't qualify for the list because they have triggers. You know, something like a Vindicators comes to mind where you've got twin sticks, but you've also got triggers. Triggers, no triggers, you know.
Yeah.
So you had to be clever. And then we're looking right now at the video. If you're watching at home, you've got Warlords here. Well, the home version, this wouldn't count because it's got buttons, but the arcade version does. By the way, that's the effect that they did on that screen is awesome. You forget how cool that looks.
It's one of the best use of backgrounds that there ever was.
So I made up a list here, but I thought we'd talk about some of these games. Now, you've got sort of some categories of games that don't have buttons, right? And so I'm dying for you to chime in and maybe add some stuff to this list, okay? So you've got games that have paddles, sort of like what you talked about with the wheel. And I believe most of those games had pedals. It's very rare where you have a game where there's no pedal, just a wheel. But you do have games that have paddles, for example, your Pongs, your Breakouts. Yep. Of course, Warlords we mentioned. Those are all... Yep. Games that use this just the paddle. Someone mentioned, and I've never played this, but there's a game on the C64 called Le Mans Grand Prix that apparently strictly uses just the paddle, no button. So there you go on that one. Then you've got games that just use the joystick, one joystick. That's it.
The
Pac-Man, Miss Pac-Man. Of course, you can't have the speed chip in your Miss Pac-Man, which is the one we always like to have, isn't it?
The turbo chip one, yes.
Then you've got one of the games we're playing today is like that. You've got Frogger. It's one that only has the joystick and no buttons on it. Qbert is another one that's like that. But there's not tons and tons of these things. I'd be interested if anybody, maybe you or the check, can you think of anything off the top of your head that would fit that category of just joystick and nothing else, no buttons? that we didn't mention. I couldn't think of anything right off the top of my head. When you sit to think about it, it's hard, you know. And I mean, I'm sure there's some obscure stuff, you know. But
yeah, I mean, a great deal of your maze games were joystick only.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was due to the evolution of the arcade.
Yeah.
I don't think that games with buttons, you know, added to the complexity. And I think they were trying to keep things simple and cheap and easy to manufacture. And if you could just slap a joystick on there and a button to start, that was good to go. You know, you could do a lot of maze games like that. But really, and I'm sure you're going to get into this, your trackball and your dual stick games, I can think a lot more of those type of games than I can single stick games, even though I know there's obviously a ton of single stick games out there.
I'm glad you mentioned trackball, because I can only think of one trackball game that doesn't have a button. Now, maybe you know tons of them, but the only one I could come up with was Marble Madness. Because even something like a Crystal Castles, for example, has a button.
Has a jump.
Yeah, so I can't think of any other trackball games that don't have buttons. So I can think of one, but it's a sort of an oddball game I'll get to. But that's, I mean, you would think, I'm looking at our chat here. Buck Owens has chimed in with a couple of games that don't have buttons. Stunt Cycle, which I believe doesn't have any buttons, Paperboy does have a button.
So yeah, Paperboy,
which you also mentioned. So trackball, you can't come up with any except for Marble Madness, is what you're telling me.
You know,
yeah, it's hard.
I did not make a list of these.
Yeah,
and I probably should, because I actually flipped through quite a few before choosing what I chose. Trackball. Yeah, there are. You're right. There are so many with a button.
Right.
I mean, even like Crystal Castles.
Or Missile Command.
If that game didn't have a jump button.
Yeah.
It would probably still be a playable game. I don't think it'd be as much fun, obviously.
Yeah.
It's
tough. Now,
so
here's a category where you've got, and this is not a complete list of these, because there were tons of these I never heard of, but I made a semi-complete list, I guess. Twin stick games. These are your games such as Smash TV, Black Widow, Robotron 2084, which is probably the mother of all twin stick games.
Yeah,
you've got the Crazy Climber series. I like Crazy Climber in the arcade. I always thought that was kind of a neat game. And the second one's really graphically impressive.
Don't like Crazy Climber.
There's a game called QB3, which I've never heard of. Then you've got another one of the sort of the seminal titles of Twin Sticks. You've got Karate Champ, which I love that game too. That game I almost picked this week because I'm such a huge fan of it. It's such a great game. Draco, Angel Kids, Bullet. Libble Rabble, Splat. I remembered Splat. Space Dungeon, a Title Fight, which I believe you use the punching glove joysticks for that one. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
As it comes up, that's perfect timing. Screw Loose. Here's one that I remember from the old Starcade show, Munchmobile. Remember that one where you play the little car with the hands that come out either side and you have to grab stuff? I've never seen that for real, but that's out there. Mars, Rock Climber, and one I thought about that no one talks about, Atari, the Atari Corporation from back in the 70s had a game called Gotcha. It was actually a twin stick game, but the sticks looked like huge round buttons. And it's the game that had the gimmick of basically, I'm trying to put this in a family friendly way. The joysticks resembled parts of a woman's anatomy. How about that? Two of them. And yeah, they're big, round, bubbly sort of joysticks that you move to play this game. Now, eventually, they replaced those with actual joysticks because I guess it was a little too frisky.
Too risque.
Yeah, even for Atari. But if you look, the ad for it is they knew exactly what they were doing. There's a hot chick running from this guy. He's kind of grabbing her. You know, this would not fly in 2020. But for that one, so that's another one I came up with. And then there's one that sort of breaks all the molds, Brent, which I wanted to end on. Remember Wacko? We used to see Wacko all the time on Starcade, and Wacko has sticks plus a trackball and no buttons. So it's a real weird one. It's also, if you've ever seen a Wacko cabinet, it's built completely cockeyed. It's built to be leany. It's real bizarre. You know,
it's a beautiful cabinet.
I would assume that those are probably collected quite a bit these days.
I would as well.
Yeah. So anyway, that's the list of stuff I came up with. Again, this is a there weren't as many of these as I thought there were. It was a lot. It'd be a lot easier to come up with no joystick games than it would with no button games. Clearly, and if you were to get rid of all the games that have start buttons, you'd really have a rough time.
But, yeah.
There may not be any.
Oh, no, there certainly would be. But again, these are we're limiting ourselves to things we can emulate, which definitely cuts down on our gaming possibilities.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we can't the top skater game.
Yeah, yeah. Or snow.
And
or
then also you've got games like depending on how you look at a trigger. Is a trigger a button? I guess it is.
Yeah.
Which that would eliminate like the silent scope type.
Yeah,
games.
I treated the trigger like a button. So we used the patented the Brent ground rules for this. So you were very limiting. So we were tasked, Brent, with coming up with a couple of these. And you know, like I said, I almost went with Karate Champ. I'll be honest.
Would have been a good great choice.
But when are we ever going to be this way again? I'm sure I could fit Karate Champion somewhere down the line. But this week, there was one game, the second game that popped into my head, it was the number one choice, Brent. And you know me. There was a beautiful, wonderful film that came out in the 80s that encompassed everything that man holds dear. Space combat against an invading force led by an evil, decrepit monster of a man who has kidnapped your beautiful woman, and as a young prince with an incredible weapon, you have to come rescue her. Everyone knows what I'm talking about. It's Crawl. Crawl, y'all. The beautiful film came to the arcade. And so when we got Twin Sticks, you knew I had to come down this road. But before we get to the actual game, let's talk about the film a little bit. The film released in July of 83 here in the U.S. Now, this got a Christmas release in the U.K. What a gift, by the way, that would be. This was actually made, I think, in the U.K. This was a great flick directed by a fellow named Peter Yates, starring Ken Marshall, Lissette Anthony in her film debut, I might add. Freddie Jones and Francesca Annis. This was a movie that took place on the planet Crawl. And on the planet Crawl, this invading alien force just comes out of nowhere. They land their huge, foreboding castle on Crawl. And then they start wreaking havoc. They've got these slayers that come out. They're wrecking stuff. They kidnap the prince's newly married bride and take her away. So if you're the prince, what are you going to do? You're going to go confide in an ancient hermit that tells you the ways of a magical weapon. All of this is original. This is original content, not gleaned from any other movie. And the old man shows the young prince the way. And the way is he has to get this magical weapon, which is the glaive. The glaive. The most awesome weapon in the history of cinema. Picture a throwing star the size of a trash can lid that you mentally control. That's all you need to know. And so the prince, armed with the glaive, gathers up an army of thieves to make one last desperate run on this castle. And along the way, he's joined by a comically amusing wizard and a cyclops. You gotta have those guys on board. And then you make the final run on I don't want to spoil the ending for anyone, but I beseech you, go out of your way to see this film. The music was done by the same fellow that did Wrath of Khan, so the music is awesome. We used to watch this in band class all the time. It's the first time I ever saw it, was back in the day. And this movie, it was a visual delight with a lot of really expensive, awesome special effects. So, you know, when a movie like this comes out, there's going to be some games based on it, Brent. Now, I will say the movie didn't make as much money as it should have. It had about a $30 million budget, and the box office was about $17 million.
It was a complete flop.
Listen, this movie was way ahead of... People weren't ready for what Crawl was bringing to the table. But it's become a cult favorite, and well, it should. So, again, when a movie like this comes out, you know there's going to be some home cooking. And sure enough, it came out. But not only did it have a arcade release, Brent, it had a pinball release. I'm not sure the pinball actually got released, but it may have. We're not 100% sure about the pinball machine. So, flash forward to Crawl, the arcade game. Now, Crawl is a twin stick game. Now, it's an interesting twin stick game because there's actually one level of this where you only use one stick. So,
yeah.
For one level, it's a one stick game.
Yep.
So I always thought that was kind of pretty wacky. This also came out in 83, timed for the release, Brent, because there's a lot of synergy when you do that. This was
it really helped those box office numbers.
Well, take off. This was released by Gottlieb. It's funny, Brent, both our games this week were made by people that didn't generally make a lot of video games. And this is what Gottlieb known for their pinball division. At the time. So this was, they were kind of walking outside our comfort zone here. This was a vertical arcade machine. Like I said, twin sticks. You could play two-player hot seat on it. And you had 2 8-way joysticks. Now, Crawl is an interesting game. You know, I like these games that are like mini games. You know what I'm saying? I've got a soft spot for these.
Your Trons.
That's right. Now, Crawl is a fascinating study in mini game structure here. The first level of Crawl finds you. First of all, you take the role of the prince, and you're going to rescue the fair maiden. And the first
that's about where the game and movie similarities end.
Au contraire, mon frère. That's not true. And I'm going to match all this stuff up. So,
on
the first
good.
Level, you are tasked with. You have to assemble the glaive. Your ultimate. Now, you in the movie, you didn't assemble it, but you did have to go up a rocky cliff to retrieve it, okay? And so it was like with rock slide. So the first level of this, you start at the bottom of the screen, and there are chunks of the glaive scattered all over the screen. You've got to go collect them all to form the ultimate weapon. So you've got to, all you do is use one joystick to move your guy around to pick him up. Sounds simple. Well, there's tons and tons of boulders coming down the screen.
Man-seeking boulders.
And the boulders, first of all, and we'll get to this, but the boulders have a real, there's a sound effect for the boulders. They sound really good. And one thing you'll notice in this game is whenever a chime or a sound comes up, it's really gnarly and awesome because Gottlieb had all those cool pinball sound effects, and they used them in this. They'd say, you could guarantee you this is from one of their pinball machines.
Yes, they had really, this game has good sound, sound effect.
And so, but you move your guy around the board to pick up the glaive, and there are trees scattered around that you have to sort of avoid. That's the level. What did you think of the first level of Crawl, Brett?
This is a decent level.
Yeah.
When the boulders run over the trees, they kind of knock the leaves off the trees. That's kind of a neat effect. The boulders, however, are beyond unpredictable. I mean, they go down the screen unless they want to just move left or right all of a sudden.
Yeah.
They'll just do it. You know, they'll shimmy, they'll shake. I understand what they were trying to do, and it does add an element of difficulty to the level that needs to be there.
Yeah.
It needs to be there. So I give this part of the game a huge thumbs up.
And the boulders look cool. They roll convincingly, and the sound effect for the boulders is top shelf. Right across the board. I like this level. It's a lot of fun. And if you're good at it, and I'm really good at it. You can even chase boulders down. Like I'll run right across boulders and just and you can sort of predict where they're going to go. So it's some of my Donkey Kong training paying off. So the next level of the game, you've got to assemble your army. Okay,
that's like Donkey Kong.
Now this level is sort of in an odd way. It's sort of like Robotron. You've got your I'm getting there. Your army, and in the movie, he has to recruit an army of thieves to help him rescue his woman from these aliens. And so the army of thieves is represented by these green-shirted guys that kind of wander around the playfield. And the playfield has some pits in it and some, deadly plants that are there. And so as the prince, you've got to run around, and you've got to just touch your army. You've got to grab them. Now, which is much like the family in Robotron. And, of course, there are slayers coming at you. The slayers, these, white guys, these white, jagged-looking guys that have these, in the movie, they had these, too. They have these, spears that can shoot bolts of energy at you, like lasers. Now, these slayers are tough. And what makes them hard is, and this, I think, was sort of a flaw because it made the game really tough, is the slayers do a lot of diagonal shooting. and that they're shooting crosses, and it makes it real difficult to dodge a lot of their lasers. I mean, this game is, this level and all the levels with the Slayers can be real tough because their firing is real tough to dodge. But once you collect all your troops, the Slayers stop coming. You knock, you kill the rest of the Slayers, and then they're gone. Now, we should mention the Prince shoots the glaive. In this game, the glaive is, instead of one large, awesome glaive, you sort of got a bunch of, like, mini glaives. So he shoots, does. Like, bullets. And they come back to him. So you can kill guys on the way back, too. And you use one stick to move around and one stick to shoot the glaive in whatever direction you want. It's a pretty, it works pretty well. The glaive's a cool weapon. But the Slayers are tough. And like I said, this level's a kind of a, this, it ramps up the difficulty quite a bit. What did you think of that one?
This is by far the hardest and dumb. It's not the dumbest level, but it's the hardest level in the game, in the loop, because there are so many enemies and there are some on-screen pitfalls that you have to watch out for and avoid. Having to collect your army as your army runs in random directions, often getting themselves killed is kind of annoying.
They can
and
get
stupid.
Killed, yeah.
But, you know, it's okay.
They make a cool sound, too. They go, ow!
I think we're going to disagree on the coolness of the sound.
It's an amusing sound. So the third screen is sort of like the second screen. I will say, this screen sort of baffles me. It's a picture, it's the same concept as the second screen. You've got to rescue your men. But then you have to touch this hexagon that will float around. Now, it's my experience for this level is that the hexagon sort of floats towards you, and if you just get anywhere near it, it'll just come to you. So I don't know what that adds. I don't know what was going on here, but having to fight these guys in the building, I think this is actually easier than the second level, but it's still not easy. The Slayers are all over the place, and you've got to rescue your men and then touch the hexes. What'd you think of the third level of this?
This is the worst level in the game. It makes no sense. This was like they had elements of other games or elements that they worked on. They're like, well, crap, we got to do something with these hexagons. I don't know. Let's make him have to get men and then touch a hexagon. It makes no sense. Again, once again, you're saving the army that you put together.
You save them a lot in this game, Brent. Yeah. So
yes, you do.
The next level is a level, and I'm going to try to make this work in the realm of the film. And once you made the final push in the film to rescue the princess, some of the guys get stuck in this building, and I guess that's what this is. But I'm not sure where the relevance of this in the film, because what you've got is a large hexagonal building that flashes colors, purple and green and black. And whenever it's black and you hit it with the glaive, you'll blow that wall away with the glaive. And so you basically, now eventually some troops will come out, but if you're quick enough and it's not hard, you just stand in front of the hexagonal thing, blow it away real quick before any troops show up, and then your guys come pouring out. You've rescued those guys again.
Yes.
So it's the third time you've had to rescue your army. I'm guessing you weren't too keen on this one either, this particular board.
No, this board somehow... I put it one step above the last board only because it's different.
It looks cool, sort of. Building stuff.
I guess.
Cool. It makes you feel like a big man. You're crushing the building with a glaive.
It's literally hit up a few times, you win.
Yeah, that's the way it
should
be.
You don't have to move.
No.
You don't have to do anything. Just hit up a few times with your shooting glaive and you win.
I just rush it.
And then the level's over.
I just rush the building and just... And the thing is, you don't want to hit it when it's not black, because it doesn't do anything, just wait. But it's black pretty quick. You go in now.
And it stays black for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
And you blow away like four walls and you win. It literally, that's it.
Yeah, and your men stream out, so they're good to go. So the final level, and this is where you confront the Beast himself, okay? The Beast is the leader of the aliens. He's this big, how would you describe the Beast? He's fish-like in a way, or reptilian. It's amazing to me that this guy can run an army, because he seems animalistic to me, but he does, you know, who knows. So the Beast is there, and the Beast has sort of like the Beast's version of the glaive, which that he didn't have that in the, I mean, he did shoot stuff in the film. I will say, in the movie, we should probably get into this, in the final scene in the movie, the prince rolls in with the glaive, right? And he's chipping away at this thing to get access to the beast. And finally, and Glaive is like a bandsaw or something. It hits that thing, it spins, and you can hear it cutting into it, you know. The Glaive has multiple uses. I mean, you can use it at the house. You can do stuff. Remember those roots I had to cut out of the ground? I could have used the Glaive right there. So
the Glaive is multi-purpose.
So the funny thing is, in the film, when he finally gets that shield away and he's actually confronting the beast in the film is a lot bigger. I mean, big. He takes his Glaive and chucks it at the beast and sticks it in the beast's back, but he can't get it out. So that's the last time you see the Glaive. It goes down with the beast. You know, and that's not what kills the beast either. The Glaive hurts him, but it doesn't kill him. So I always thought to myself, that's kind of a crummy way to take out the Glaive. I would have been mad if I was the prince because they had the ultimate weapon. So anyway, in the game here, the Glaive does nothing to the beast. They got that part right. It just irritates him and scores you points.
Make him kind of turn every once in a while.
This is one of the strangest end boss setting of all time to me. Because picture a big room with doors on either side, like hallways. And then in the middle of the room, you've got the beast, you've got you. And at the top, you've got Nyssa, and she's waving like, I'm up here
the whole time.
Yeah. And so you have to avoid. All you do is run up, avoid the beast shots, and just touch the princess. That's it. And what's great about it is, and you can shoot the beast 30 times. He doesn't care.
Doesn't matter.
The best part is that when you finish the level, the beast just sort of defeatedly walks off screen. It goes out one of the halls.
Exit stage left.
And your army, who you had to rescue 3 times, they come streaming out the other side of the doors and give you a strike a pose. They were real helpful. They didn't do jack squat. They didn't do anything. They're a worthless army. And then you win. And then it loops back to the boulder level. That's your game. I have to say, it's pretty. In the arcade, it's funny. I remember in the arcade being pretty good at this game, and I could beat it. I could flip it a couple times. You know, it's easier with a proper control setup than it is playing with a gamepad. But I don't remember the beast being that hokey. Maybe I was just so excited to get to him. But I wondered if you could kill him with the Glaive. And so I put myself in invulnerable and played this, and just peppered him with the Glaive. Just peppered him nonstop. And I could never kill him with the Glaive.
I didn't think so.
As far as I could tell, the beast is unkillable. And presumably he slinks off, and that's why the game starts over. You have to go do it. Maybe he took the Glaive and ripped it apart, threw it on that hill again. You have to do it again. You know, you go back. So, final thoughts on this one, Brent. What was your appraisal of Krull the game?
Well, let's talk about the last level real quick.
Okay.
Like you said, this is another one. You don't have to shoot. There's no reason to shoot.
Well, you get points.
No, there's no reason to shoot. You've got some projectiles on the screen, which are fairly easy to avoid.
Yeah.
You just walk up the screen. You touch the princess. The enemy, just tucks his tail and runs. Which I think the big boss guy, he looks taller than your character.
Yeah,
in
the film, he's way bigger. I mean, he's monstrous. Right.
But I think this was a good representation through sprites. and then your worthless army. See, when I hit the princess and beat the loop, I thought we rescued the army for another time. And they were like, yay, and they all ran out of their little cages.
That may have been you're saying we had to rescue the army, what, three or four? That'd be one, two, three. That'd be four rescues of the army.
I'm going to go ahead and give my synopsis of this game.
Oh, please.
First of all, it's a really bad game.
What?
And it is a bad game for a lot of reasons. First of all, it's completely nonsensical. The first level, I'll give them total props for. Collect the Glaive. You got the rocks coming down. Everything makes sense, all right? You got the trees that do the cool effect when the boulders hit them.
Yeah.
Good screen. Second screen, you collect an army. You fight the bad guys. It's sort of fun. It's challenging. I guess it sort of works in the story. You know, you're building this army, even though the army is suicidal and will just walk right into the enemy's path and will actually run from you Because the soldiers just walk in random directions. So I often had to chase them down to collect them. And then from there on out, the game is a disaster.
Disaster?
No, it's a disaster. Because the gameplay elements of the hexagon, taking the men and putting them in the hexagon, stupid, first of all.
That doesn't make any sense.
It offers no challenge or no reward from a gameplay standpoint, because literally the hexagon comes to you and you just kind of, so you're just collecting the men again.
I think they put that in just to be like, look, it's different, but it's not really different.
No.
You know?
Next stage, you got the castle, right? Complete waste. Literally tap up 4 times, you win.
Yeah, that's true.
It has no purpose.
Looks cool. This is 83. Pretty cool looking graphics.
And then the endings, you don't fight the boss at the end. You just avoid him. You touch the princess and you win. The army meant nothing. Busting out of the army out meant nothing. So much of the game means nothing that the design is just horrible. The story elements are horrible. I know it's 83. I know games in this time period didn't really have a lot of story, but all of this was just screen after screen of screen of random gameplay, and bad random gameplay at that. So when you package all of that together, you get a game with decent sound effects. I would even say good sound effects. The controls themselves work, even though half the time you're not using both controls. I don't think it's faithful to the film. It would have been just as palatable gameplay wise to only throw one glaive, and that you could, you know, maybe you threw it and then you use the other stick to control it. At least that would have made some sense. So it's not good to its source material. This is literally the definition of a bad game. I would certainly not seek this out into the arcade to play it. You're not going to gain anything from it. Plus, it's going to be hard to find. I certainly wouldn't seek out to emulate this. Most emulators, though, this is on MAME and it emulates fine. So you do have that, you can just pop it in and play it. If you want to laugh, you know, spend 5 minutes with the game and then you're done.
I think you can consider, number one. I think it does fit the film pretty well, and I mean for the most part, you got to think this is 83, you know. And is this as good as Tron? No. Okay, but I think that's sort of what they were shooting for. The levels get a little bit redundant, but I think it's fun. It's also wacky, and I will say at the end of the game where you defeat the beast. The army does give you points, so if you rescue more of them, you get more points. I'm just saying, it's points. It's the 80s. That's what you want to do, points. I like this game. I think it's a lot of fun. I think it's perfectly suitable for the wacky film it's based on. I really do, and you know this for certain. I love Crawl. I love that movie.
I know you do.
And I love it.
I know your love blinds you.
No, I love it for all of its warts and everything. It's just such a goofy film. I like the fact that they took everything that was popular and tried to smash it into one bizarre film. And
yes.
I mean, you've got all kinds of, and the thing is, they didn't include the Cyclops or the
exactly.
the wizard in this, which they could have. But I mean,
they
again,
could have had gave them stages.
This is 83, they did an okay job. But I mean, this is another thing that took other games and sort of put them together, sort of like the film did. So I don't have a problem with it. I like it. I would hunt this out. I would search it out.
Are you kidding?
Oh yeah, it's great. Now something I want to mention.
Also, I do want to say,
oh, yeah.
This is one of the easiest games to loop.
Well,
you
I'm,
can loop it on your second playthrough, guaranteed.
If you can get past the second level and the third level, you're golden.
The second level is the only hard level in the entire.
Those are the money levels. The rest of it, you're not too bad. You know, I looked on Klob to get some overall impressions on this thing. The overall score it's got on Klob, which granted with very few people chiming in, was a 2.55 out of 5. It was actually pretty well collected on Klob. Klob was the killer list of video game. It's like basically like arcade owners get together, and it's got all kinds of information about it. Something else I found out. It's funny when I was looking for video or for images. They actually released a they had a flyer release that had the numbers on this and how it was doing in big arcades. That was, they were using it as a selling point. And in like three big markets, I think it was like Philadelphia and like L.A. and Chicago or something. Cause it was number two at the time when it was released, behind Pole Position. Pretty good. Now, these numbers could have been fudged, but it, still, I thought that it's one of the few times I actually get to find something that resembles numbers.
What you find out is the arcade only has two games in it.
What, they've got this in Pole Position?
That's it.
What a jerk. What a big old jerk you are. Let me see if anybody bothered to review this. Oh, yes. Oh, good. I was hoping somebody would. Graham W. Vebke chimes in, Brent. This game at first seems to play well with the two joysticks only, but it soon becomes a very frustrating game. Level 1, you collect the glaive blade weapon while avoiding the boulders. It's easy enough the first time around. Level 2, you need to rescue your army. But why do these guys run away from you like morons? That's true, they do that. Your weapon works like a boomerang, and you can't fire it again until it returns to you. Of course, you get like multiple ones. You need to kill all the enemy after rescuing everyone, and the screen gets pretty busy here. Level 3 is frustrating as you are restricted by the landform, and your army is still stupid, running away from you. They are thieves. What do you want? Level 4, you shoot the hexagon building, and your army escapes running towards you. Level 5 is like a boss level, and you must reach a princess, I think, at the top of the screen, avoiding all the bouncing enemy attacks. And if you win, it loops and gets harder. The graphics aren't that special, and the sounds are like they ripped right out of a Gottlieb pinball. There you go. It's okay in small doses, but I'm not going to play this again. 5 out of 10. A scathing,
I think that is a brutally fair review.
Scathing review from Graham. So
brutally fair.
I enjoyed this game. By the way, I looked. There were no crawls currently for sale, but I've seen, you know, nowadays video games, God only knows what they're going for, man. It's crazy.
Yeah.
That's your crawl, everybody. A game that I think you should seek out and play at least once. Brent, what did you bring to the table this week, my friend?
Boy, did I go a different direction. I went deep into the archives of one-stick maze games, and I picked a classic that no one talks about, and that can only mean we're taking a look at Nibbler. Let's real quick talk about some of the history of Nibbler. What made Nibbler famous? Nibbler is the first video game that added an extra digit to your score, which meant it looped at 1 billion points.
Oh, okay.
1 billion points. And that became the focus of everything. And this is one of those things where a bigger score makes something popular. It happened in pinball. When pinball started adding stupid, ridiculous scores, instead of hitting a target and getting 10 points, you got 10,000 points. It actually helped boost pinball's popularity, and they saw a surge in profits. That is why you see pinball machines nowadays with just stupid, ridiculous scores. That's true fact. So Rockola, who made Nibbler, decided that they were going to go the extra mile, put in the extra digits, and the rolls at 1 billion points. So why does that? Did that really work? Did it really make the game famous? Absolutely. And the reason why is it got news crews out to people who were playing this game who were going to get to the 1 billion points. And Tim McVeigh, not the brutal terrorist, this incredible, the unfortunate name, but an incredible guy. Back in 1984 at the Twin Galaxies Arcade, when he was 16 years old, he looped 1 billion points after 44 hours of marathon gameplay. 44 straight hours. Walter Day, who runs the Twin Galaxy Arcade, he is a showboat. He works the crowd, right? Yes, he got all of the press there. They actually made the town He didn't make the town. He suggested the town give him Tim McVeigh the key to the city, which they did. They made a civil day called Tim McVeigh Day.
Wow.
Where they put up big banners to celebrate his accomplishment. It was a huge deal. And it made people really start looking at the, you know, points, and it was great press for the game, obviously. And that's what really fueled the popularity of Nibbler for a time. And the reason why it's popular now is this is one of those marathon games, one of those high school marathon games that is just has an epic story. And it's told absolutely beautifully in a documentary called Man vs. Snake. Now, it's a little unfortunate that they kind of did the King of Kong thing to it, where, yes, it's a documentary, but they really, they have your good guy and they have your bad guy. And it, you know, it tells a story. And I respect that. You've got to make your film interesting and everything like that. But they did a few things that really did this game a misservice, because Tim McVeigh had thought he had lost this record, right? There was an Italian player who unofficially beat the record way back in 84, right? And no one ever knew about it until decades later. So the documentary kind of follows Tim McVeigh as he's trying to regain his score. And he does, spoiler alert, he does reclaim his score at the end. And they have Dwayne Richards as kind of the evil guy in this. Although Dwayne is a stand-up guy, super good at arcade games, he's one of these guys that plays everything. And he has a third-place high score, I believe, is what it currently ranks at. But some of the most interesting stuff they don't go into on the documentary, and I had to learn after the fact. Technically speaking, on Twin Galaxies right now, Tim McVeigh has the high score, okay? But there are two individuals whose names I unfortunately do not have right at hand who have beaten that high score and are not recognized for two different reasons. One guy did not film it. There were people there who can verify the score, but Twin Galaxies has a very rigid, or did, they're under new management now, but they have a very rigid score submittal process. And the guy said, look, this, I cannot submit the score. It will not pass muster.
Plus, you had guys there for like 3 days or whatever. I mean, come on.
54 yeah, hours.
It's hard to believe that people stood around 54 and watched hours. It all that. So it's why you have to tape that. I understand.
But it is widely believed that did happen, and he does have a higher score. There is another person that a hardware store hired him to come in and beat the record. And the guy had the skills, and they paid him to come in. And the agreement was in his contract that is, if you beat the high score, we own that high score, right?
Okay.
So you can't submit it. You can't do that. You know, that's us. And it was a gaming website as well that kind of worked together behind the scenes. So there's that score is out there. And it can't be submitted because it's owned, contractually owned by a third party. So it can't be submitted. So that just shows you some of the craziness that goes on with high score gaming in retro games. It's a crazy world, right? And especially now that you've got all this streaming and you've got, you know, there are people coming out who either admit to have cheating or they have the technology now to really review this footage and show that people are cheating. So some high scores are coming off the list, which are pushing some people higher. High scoring in the arcade realm for retro games, amazing tale. So Nibbler is a snake game. And if you don't know what that means, basically, you are a snake in a maze. You have no enemies except for yourself. If you run into your own tail, you die. And as you collect different objects, you grow larger. So you have to strategically go through this maze, and the snake is always going forward. You can't stop him from going forward. If he runs into a wall and you don't make a decision fast enough, he will randomly choose a direction to go. So you have to always be on your toe and know where you're going next. And that's the whole game. You get an unlimited amount of extra lives based on your score. You know, every so many points you get an extra life. And that's what makes this a marathonable game. There are only a set number of mazes. The mazes aren't random, so you can have patterns to best get through them. And it allows you to build up enough men. The men track to 99, but you can still go higher than that without looping it. So you can build up, you know, 150 men, step away from the game, and sure, you'll continuously die because you'll run out of time. The time limit will keep ticking down, but you can actually go use the bathroom, get something to eat. Some people take naps during this time, and that's what marathon gaming is all about. Any game where you can get unlimited number of extra lives and there is a way to step away from it, you know, it's crazy that these people play these games for 30, 40, 50 hours at a time.
But they're not technically. So, I mean, when you're, if you build up 150 men and you've got, what is it, 1,000 seconds, well, probably you got 500 seconds or however it gets down. I mean, you.
Well, it counts down from 1,000 seconds. A time unit. They're not seconds. It does it in groups of 10.
Oh, I see.
And the later levels, the timer is much faster.
That's something I was going to ask you.
I think you get like 20 seconds per life.
Uh-huh. Now does the game, is there any sort of, aside from the timer, is the difficulty increase as you loop it, or does it just...
Speed. It's all about
speed. So the snake
speed.
Gets faster.
The snake I does see. Get faster. It does eventually cap. But Nibbler, the game is all about speed. If you're going to play it casually, you are going to sit down and you're going to play the first few levels and think, what in the world's going on? This is so easy. This is stupid. And then the snake is going to get so fast. And every time he runs into a wall that you don't turn in time, he kind of grinds against it. It makes this grinding noise. Yeah. And every time the snake forms, it goes romp, romp, romp. And it's an iconic sound. Like, it's something that any old school gamer can hear that sound and know exactly what game it's coming from. But the game's difficulty, I mean, how far did you get into it?
You're watching me play right now if you're watching the feed, the live feed. You know, I didn't like this with a gamepad. I can tell you that right now. This is what you need a joystick for.
You need a
four-way
agree.
Joystick. That's what you need. Because inevitably, my guy would get to a point where I didn't turn quick enough. He'll sort of go on his own in a weird way.
Yes, he absolutely does.
And so you have to... You don't have a lot of time to make a decision when you make a turn. And so I'm watching my footage here, and I knew people were going to watch this and be like, man, who's playing this? This guy sucks. Which I do. But... The truth of the matter is, you'll make a dumb decision that you don't make. It sort of makes it for you if you don't go quick enough.
Yes.
And the snake just, because he's got a big wad of himself behind him, he don't have a choice. And it's in some ways, it's like a perpetual game of Tron's light cycles. Except you're in a maze, and it's really like I was telling you before the show. I've never played this until this show. Yeah, I'd played snake games, but not like this. Most of the ones I've played were like, they didn't have a board. And I'll have to say, this is a pretty clever game. And it is, it's, you know, this requires some forethought and some memorization of patterns, none of which are my forte, as you know. I don't think I did well. I got to seven or so levels in, I think. Do you know how many boards there are? Are there hundreds or are there 10?
No, I think there's 12 or so boards before the repeat. But the difficulty of this game, from a casual standpoint, right? I'm not talking about the marathoners. The marathoners have patterns for all this thing, and their real battles versus fatigue later on. Because the game's fast, and you have to, I mean, when you're playing the game to get to the levels, you have to be on your game. You have to really know which way to go. You're whipping the joystick back and forth and left and right. But from a casual standpoint, most people are going to get probably to wave 10, 12, 15. Well, if you're willing to play it long enough to get some idea of what's going on, that's roughly how far you're going to get.
Yeah.
But if you can imagine setting and standing and playing this game for, I mean, the record, the minimum you have to play this game to get the record is 45 hours. 45 hours. That's insane.
Yeah. The funny thing is, and you mentioned King of Kong briefly. I remember watching King of Kong. The assistant editor in that, or the guy that worked with Walk Today back in those days, talked about watching a Nibbler World Record, and it was like 7 or 8 VCR tapes, and sitting in his apartment and watching it. And so that's how I knew of Nibbler, and I knew it was a game that you could marathon. But that's pretty much the extent of my knowledge. And I have to say, playing this game for an extended period of time would. Obviously, the guys that do it have it all memorized, because otherwise it would make you. I thought it was a pretty difficult game to be. For an arcade game, I didn't think it was difficult because I got to the 7th or 8th level pretty easy, you know. But to get to marathon it, it seems like it would be an incredible feat.
It's a proper high score game. It really
and there's
is.
There's not much
it's a
to
proper
it.
Endurance high score game. A few things I want to point out. People who play this competitively talk about going colorblind.
Yeah.
Because they are...
Repeat that again. You cut out for a second. They talk about what now?
Oh, sorry. People who play this game marathon-wise mention that they have color blindness because they are staring at that mostly black screen for so long with just the red... that when they step away from the game, all they see is red because their eyes have kind of walked out on them. You know, that's after 40 hours.
That's crazy.
A few things I want to clear up that the wiki page has wrong.
Oh, good work, sir.
Tim McVeigh was 16 when he set this record, not 17. And for doing it, he got his own Nibbler arcade game. Rockola said, the first person who gets 1 billion points, we're going to give an arcade game to. He later, and not much later, sold that arcade game. And the wiki says something that he did it for $200 worth of tokens. That's incorrect. He actually did it for $200 cash. And $1,000 worth of tokens, and not at Twin Galaxies, but at a rival arcade down the street. And he didn't do that to be vindictive or anything like that. He actually offered the game to Walter Day first, but Walter Day already had one, so you know he just went somewhere else to sell it. And there's no bad blood there at all.
I like the idea that there were competing arcades on the same street. I wish we still had that. That's the 80s right there, the early 80s where you had... arcades everywhere. That would be great. But it's good that I can understand that too. But $200, that seems really cheap for a new game.
16 years old, and you have to think he also got $1,000 worth of tokens. So he could, I mean, if your thing is playing video games, you know, part of your pastime is playing video games, that is as good as $1,000 cash.
You
now,
think
obviously,
after 50-some hours, you'd probably want to wean yourself. Maybe he just got sick of it. Maybe he looked at it and it made him sick. He's like, I'm so sick of that
story,
game.
You know, the game showed up. The guy put it off the back of his truck, and he said, there you go. And Tim McVeigh and his mother was like, are you going to help us get this in the house? He's like, nope, and drove off. And when they got it into his house and they put it in his bedroom, and they have a picture of it where it takes up like 1/4 of his bedroom. So, and he was sick of playing the game. You know, he regrets selling it now, of course, because it actually had a unique kick plate from the factory, a unique color.
Do we know where that game's at?
Gone. No one knows where it's at. It's been looked for.
Oh man.
One other thing I want to mention, and this is involving the documentary, Dwayne Richard is made out to be the evil guy in this game, as I mentioned earlier. He had a board that played faster than a normal board, right? And the only, because he set a record, he got over 1 billion points. He was the world record holder for a short while. And it only turned out later when they were comparing footage side by side, they saw his game was running faster. So they said, yep, you know, the guy's cheated. He modified his ROM. They took his board into, you know, get it looked at. And the guys read all the ROM chips, and all the ROM chips were fine. And they eventually read his processor,
yeah,
you know, the 6508, and it was running fast. Nothing, it hadn't been modified. It was just running fast.
Sure.
So, Dwayne Richards, if somehow you ever see this, I believe you, sir. I think you're a good man. Tim McVeigh believed him, but the documentary kind of made him out to be the villain, which I think was very unfair. I mean, I know you have to do that kind of thing in filmmaking, but it made me kind
of
sad.
Well, you know, I will say this, and of course, if we've both seen King of Kong, we love that movie, and yeah, it's a well-made film. And of course, now it's easy to vilify Billy Mitchell because
it's much easier now, yeah, than it was. Yeah,
I don't have a problem. I mean, listen, Billy's done some shitty stuff, but I mean, the guy is an elite level player, and certainly was the best player in the world for a long time. But all that aside, and if you take aside all the stuff that happened recently, not only was Billy not evil, he was super charitable back when that game was made, and he actually helped out Weeby. He helped this guy out. Now, if you listen to an old retro gaming radio show where Shane interviews both those guys together, this is well before the movie. It was right about the same time they were actually would have been competing for the score, and they're both super friendly, get along. Weeby's a big,
of course,
Weeby's a big fan of Billy, so they use a lot of movie baloney in there. But still, you got to have a heel, and Billy was the scene in that movie where Billy's getting himself primed, and they're playing The Stroke, and he's getting himself all his hair all fixed up. It's one of my all time, and he struts out in that suit and that tie. I just love it because, you know, I'm a wrestling guy, and this guy's like, would have worked. You could have walked him right into a wrestling arena, gave him a microphone, and let him cut a promo. I love that. So I'm looking forward to seeing Man vs. Snake. I'd not heard of that until Mr. Owens shed some light on it for me.
I absolutely give Man vs. Snake a huge thumbs up. I definitely, you can rent it from Amazon or purchase it if you'd like. It's definitely worth an hour and a half of watch. Thoroughly enjoyed every minute of it. Back to Nibbler real quick, since I guess that is what we're reviewing.
Yeah.
I think this game is a classic. If you are a... you know, this game's been done a million times, but it's never been done quite like this. It's worth taking a look at. You're not going to sit down and play it for 45 hours unless, you know, you're a marathon gamer. But I think it deserves its place in history for being the first billion-point video game. And for that alone, you should take a peek and see where it's at. These sell for, in minty fresh condition, you can get an arcade cabinet for about $2,500. So I think that's a little high for a game of this caliber, but, you know, the cabinet was in prim, perfect condition.
Yeah.
You can get the PCB for this for about $170.
Yeah.
Which I think is more on par of what this game's actually worth.
Really, without the CAD, you'd have to make some adapters to get this to work in something.
Right. And emulation-wise, you can emulate it a billion different ways. It's super easy to emulate, and I highly recommend seeking it out through emulation and giving it a shot.
I will say, I was looking at this thing up earlier, and it did actually, unlike my game, this actually got a couple home ports.
Two.
Yeah. Believe this, I don't see it listed, but I thought the Spectrum got a port of this too, but I know the Atari computers got a port, and I believe was it the Apple II?
Apple II.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there you go. There you go. We did get a listener review on this. That's our good friend Graham. Graham writes, an arcade game that kind of reminds me of Jungler, which we played. Remember that one?
Yep.
And I can see greatly influenced the popular Nokia phone game Snake. Essentially, this is a maze game where you need to pick up all the pieces, throughout the maze, and after each piece is collected, your worm grows. Your only enemy is your own growth. The speed of each level increases in the time counter, and that's part of the challenge here. If your head touches any part of your body, you will die, so you need to take each turn with care, making sure your path is clear. The game would have been a real quarter muncher in the day. I still struggle to get past wave 6 or 7. Thank you, Graham. That's the same as me. It's not bad for its time. 8 out of 10, Brent.
I think that's very fair.
So, you know, as we look over these games, Brentster, your final thoughts on controlling... What did you think of the controlling mechanism, or just the controlling mechanisms in general of twin stick games, or games that don't have any buttons and you require a stick or a trackball? I mean, are you into that sort of thing?
Back then, absolutely. They were simpler. Not twin stick games so much, but single sticks games for sure.
Mm-hmm.
They were easier for young me to understand. Maze games in general were one of my favorites growing up because the concepts were easy. The gameplay was easy. It was still rewarding because you got to finish a stage, and that felt good. Twin stick games back in the day were mind-blowing to me. I could not figure them out. Games like Robotron, I would play them and die just immediately because I would mess up my walking stick versus my shooting stick. Was really bad at them.
Yeah.
Now, as a more mature gamer, as an older gamer, a more experienced gamer, now maze games and single stick games, for the most part, are too easy. You know, the thrill of just getting through a level is not as good unless a game has speed, like Ms. Pac-Man with the turbo chip, or Nibbler is a game that's fast enough. A lot of those single stick games can't hold my interest. However, dual stick games, Smash TV, Total Carnage, going back and looking at Robotron again, now I'm super into these games because the concept of being able to walk backwards while shooting forwards, that kind of stuff really appeals to me. So as I've aged, my opinions on single and dual stick games have really flip-flopped. And when you talk about games that don't use buttons in general in the arcades, you usually get your gimmick games, you know, your arm wrestling, or you're on an exercise bike, or you're on a snowboard. And I think those things are perfect for arcade games because they allow you to experience something that you're not going to get in your home console world. So I big thumbs up for the creativity behind those. But when everything boils down to what am I going to play on a more day-to-day basis, it's going to be controllers and mouse and keyboards. I think that's the best way to control video games.
Very good. Very well said. And by the way, you mentioned Total Carnage. You might have noticed it wasn't on our list. It has a bomb button, unfortunately.
It does have a bomb button.
So, we do have something here that doesn't have a button. It's the wheel, Brent. It's the wheel. Tell them what we've done this week, Brent.
We, unfortunately, with John Boat of Carshaller, moving on to a bigger and better career, a few shows had to be dropped from the Amigos retro gaming spectrum.
Put on hiatus, we'd like to say. Include
the Atari 1200 XL show, the Sinclair show, and the TRS-80 show. So we only thought it was fair to let the wheel choose. Let the wheel decide. We're going to lock those pieces into their positioning, even if they get spun, until the Thanksgiving marathon at the end of November.
That's right. I love
it. So hopefully... I'm hoping we get some of these things to come up at least a couple times. I would love to do shows for a lot of those systems. And, of course, we still have our Retro Rewind piece, is where we put in a piece from a previous show. This week is a Commodore 64 piece.
Commodore 64.
So, Aaron, you want to give that thing a good old spin?
I want to give this thing a good hearty spin. Here we go. Oh! Had to grunt on that spin. It was so brutal. And we've picked... What do we got here? Underground Games. We were just talking about this, Brent. Underground Games. Tell the people what that means, because I was completely in the dark on Underground Games.
Underground Games is not what you think. It's not those shady back alley games that you get from the man in the trench coat.
That's what I thought it was.
These are games. that take place underground. You can have an intro sequence where your man has a cutscene that goes underground, a la like a Dig Dug.
Yeah.
But the gameplay itself must take place underground.
Now, can this be across arcade and console, whatever, as long as it's underground, right?
Well, you know what? I think since this week we did arcade games.
Okay.
I think for the week coming up, we should choose a console or computer game.
All right. I like it. I like the way you're thinking, dude. Hey, listen, everybody. We'd like to thank everyone for joining us this week on the show. You can catch all of our shows on anchor.fm. If that's your bag, every show we've ever done is on there. It goes up instantly as soon as we finish the live stream. And we would be more than happy if we would check us out on Anchor. You can also sponsor us on anchor.fm, sort of like Patreon. It's a pretty easy way to go, and we would appreciate any help along those ways. We would like to thank our good buddy BarkBit for our closing scene, Brent. And, of course, we've got to thank
Theme,
Doug.
Not scene.
Theme. That's why I said theme. We also like to thank Doug for our cool Tron-like 3D graphics. Next week, Brent, we'll be in studio. I sort of put it off for a week due to my laziness. Also, it was raining so much I couldn't hear in there. So I was like, "Listen, let's go one more week on the video." But we'll be back in studio next week for some hot underground action. Any parting thoughts, Brent, before we shut this sucker down?
I thought this was a fun week. I highly encourage everyone to go watch Man vs. Snake. I think it is a super well edited. And great flow in a documentary. And plus, it's very entertaining content.
And I urge everyone to go watch Tron, and I mean Crawl, and Tron. Watch them both. Watch both, but watch Crawl. Crawl is awesome. And if you can hunt it down, get the simulated Crawl pinball machine too. Everything Crawl. By the way, if anyone can point me to a place where I can order a glaive. I was dying to get me a glaive, Brent, but I can't. They used to sell them, but they're hard to find these days. Glaive. We'd like to thank everybody in the chat room, Brent. You want to say shout out to anybody in the chat room? I'm looking at quite a few people here.
Let's just run down some of our lurkers. We got Anton. We got Bitstorm, Crazy Cynical, Duke Hudson. Looks like Graham is in chat, although he's being eerily silent. Just hitting a few more here. We got Jackie Marlington, Monty, Steve Oranges, and then, of course, we've got some of our chatters. We got Geo's Lake, Buck Owens, Duke Hudson, Pixels at Dawn, Mitz, Hermsky, Paul Kitching, DieXD96.
That rolls
said
off the tongue.
Hello, man.
Yeah.
Slash Life. You know, good chatters. I'm a P_Rick. Challenged Moose.
We got a Young Ones fan right there. That's a Young Ones reference.
Good chat room.
Very
today.
Good. We'd also like to think we got a new supporter this week, Brent. You want to give a shout out?
Well, all the shout-outs are in the video, man.
Fair enough.
Don't override the video process.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, we will see you guys next week. Enjoy our supporter video. We're going to put this thing to bed. Thanks again for joining us. We'll be back next week, same bat time, same bat channel, for Underground Games. Until then, good luck.
Thanks for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed the show as much as we enjoyed making it. We want to say hello to all of our Twitch followers, our YouTube subscribers, and our podcast listeners. We'd like to also say a special thank you to all of our Anchor.fm supporters, Hermsky, Anthony Jarvis, Chris Foles, John Schaller, Frodo NL, Gary Heather, Graham W. Vetke, and Terry Howard. You guys rock. Would you like to help ARG keep on spinning? You can become an Anchor.fm supporter at anchor.fm/ARG-presents. Don't want to have to explain another credit card bill? That's okay too. Just leave us a positive review on the Apple Podcast or Spotify Network.
A well-deserved kudos goes out to Duncan Styles for all of our vector graphics and BarkBit for our closing theme. Thanks for joining us, and we hope to see you next week, 9 a.m. Sunday EDT.